All right, today we're on Judah and Tamar. And it's interesting because we've kind of come to the end of Isaac's life. Do you remember how old Isaac was when he died? 180. And it was interesting because both his sons, Esau and Jacob, were with him when he died. And so we know that they were reconciled at this point. Isaac was buried in the cave at Machpelah along with Abraham, Sarah, and his wife, Rebekah. At this point, God's blessed both Jacob and Esau. Do you remember how many sons they both have? 12 sons. And we know they've got tons of herds and flocks and servants and everything. So at this point, the land can't support both of them. And so we find Esau moving south past the Dead Sea to an area that's called Seir, but it's got red rocks and red cliffs, which fits with his name perfectly. And we find Jacob then remaining in the area of Canaan, the land that God had promised Abraham. So Jacob's family now is on the move. They're heading towards Bethlehem. And Rachel, we didn't know was pregnant, goes into labor. And at this point, she's really struggling, and the midwife tries to encourage her, telling her, it's a son, but she dies in birth. At that point, she is buried along the road there to Bethlehem. It's about a mile outside of Bethlehem, they said. And we're noticing a trend now in this family. It's called favoritism. Have we seen it before? Yeah. And so, of course, Jacob has a favorite son, which would be Rachel's oldest son. And I've been thinking about this, and I think because Rachel was the wife he chose, her first son he's viewing as his firstborn and the one that would be the one that would carry on his name and the covenant. But there's a problem. He's got 10 older brothers, and everybody knows that Joseph is daddy's favorite. And then he puts him in a very special robe. I know it always is technicolor or colored or whatever, but culturally it would have been unique in that it was longer and it had long sleeves and it denoted that you had authority. So what did he do when he go out to the fields for his brothers? He'd have to go check on them, right? And what reports did he bring back?
Negative.
Negative. They are not doing their job right, Dad, whatever. And what's the word that we saw regarding their attitude towards Joseph? They hated him. And I think Joseph might have been a little spoiled, especially since he and his little brother that Rachel had were the only two at home and the other 10 were out tending the sheep. And we find that Joseph has two dreams. The first dream, they're out harvesting the wheat. What happened? Right. His wheat chaff stands up and all the other ones bow down. The brothers didn't appreciate that. Then he had another dream and we've got the sun and moon bowing and what else? 11 stars. And the brothers say, oh, so you think you're going to rule over us? And they hated him even more. This is not looking good for Joseph. When he turns 17, his brothers are out tending their flocks, probably their father thinks somewhere around Shechem. And you remember that that's land that Jacob actually bought when he moved there before they wiped all the men out of Shechem. But anyway, they're back there with the sheep. It had been a little too long, and so Jacob is concerned. And so he says, Joseph, go check on your brothers and then bring a report back to me. Now it's 50 miles to Shechem. He walks there, doesn't find him. What happened? Yeah, there was a man there that just happened to overhear where the brothers were going. And they were going to Dothan, which is another 14 miles. And Dothan means cisterns. So here comes Joseph walking along. It's mountainous, so they can see him coming. And of course, you would see that coat. You couldn't miss the coat. And what did the brothers plan as they see Joseph arriving?
Kill him.
Let's kill him and get rid of this troublemaker. And so as he comes closer, Reuben's the oldest, and he thinks, I'm responsible for all of these brothers. Maybe there's a better plan. What was his plan? Let's throw him in the cistern. And I thought that was very interesting because Dothan means two cisterns, and apparently it's on the trade route. You would probably stop there for your animals and try to get water. But when he comes, the first thing they do is strip off that hated robe, throw him in the cistern. And I sent you to the other text where it says Joseph was pleading for his life, but his brothers ignored him. And then they sit down to have a meal. It's like, how can you even do that? But that's not God's plan. Who's traveling on the trade route?
The Ishmaelites.
The Ishmaelites. They're spice traders. And the interesting thing is they are traveling to Egypt. They could have been going from Egypt, but this time they're going to Egypt. And so another brother comes up with a plan. Who's that other brother?
Judah
comes up with a plan. And what's his plan? Let's just sell him as a slave. Let's make some money on him. And so that's exactly what they do. But then they got a problem. How are they going to tell dad? And this is a family known for its deceit. So how did they decide to... Yeah, what kind of blood?
Goat
blood. They dip his coat in goat blood, bring it to the dad, and they say, who does this belong to? Does this belong to your son? And of course, Jacob has just lost Rachel, and he's distressed and immediately jumps to a conclusion, which is?
He was torn apart by wild animals.
Now, Jacob goes into a grieving. He's lost Rachel. Now he's lost his favorite son. And it goes on and on and on. And his family tries to console him, but to no avail. And he says, I'm going to go to my grave or Sheol grieving. So that's where our story left off last week. We know that Joseph is now in Egypt and he's been sold to Potiphar. Interesting, the highest official in the Pharaoh's court. But before we continue with Joseph's story, we have to go back to see how God is working in the life of Judah. So this is a final bridge, I would say, between Joseph's story. So let's begin today in Genesis 38, beginning with verse 1. It said, at that time, Judah left his brothers and went down to stay with a man of Adullam named Hir. There Judah met the daughter of a Canaanite man named Shua. He married her and laid with her. She became pregnant and gave birth to a son who was named Ur. She conceived again and gave birth to a son, and she named him Onan. She gave birth to still another son and named him Shelah. It was at Kizib that she gave birth to him. Now, it doesn't tell us why Judah decided to move away, but as I was thinking through the story, he was the one that came up with the idea of selling Joseph, and now he's in the presence of his father, who can't stop grieving over Joseph. I think maybe he couldn't just stay there and be in the presence of his father. So he moves to Adullam, but it's only 8 miles away, and this is a place where they would have been going anyway with the sheep, so he would be with his brothers, but they were all in the same boat there. However, when Judah's there, he finds a Canaanite woman that seems to attract his attention. So that meant he wasn't married when he moved there. And think back to what God said to Abraham and the covenant. When Abraham was going to get a wife for Isaac, he told his servant not to take a, what kind of woman?
Canaanite.
A Canaanite woman. Go to my family and find it. And then the next generation, Isaac has two sons. And Esau marries Canaanite women. And what did Rebekah say? These women are making my life miserable. So Judah knew that they weren't to marry Canaanite women, but he did anyway. And notice who got the wife. It wasn't Jacob. Judah got his own wife. And she had three sons. Ur means watcher, Onan means strong, and Shelah means probably request. Going to verse 6. So Judah got a wife for Ur, his firstborn, and her name was Tamar. But Ur, Judah's firstborn, was wicked in the Lord's sight, so the Lord put him to death. Then Judah said to Onan, lie with your brother's wife and fulfill your duty as her brother-in-law and produce an offspring for your brother. But Onan knew that the offspring would not be his, so whenever he lay with his brother's wife, he spilled his semen on the ground to keep from producing offspring for his brother. What he did was wicked in the Lord's sight, so he put him to death also. Very brief account of Judah's sons. Basically, it covers many years. He gets married, he has children, and now they are old enough to get married. But notice, this time Judah selects a wife, and he selected Tamar. We don't know why, but the fact that her name is given, we know is important in God's story. And the text says that both Ur and Onan were wicked in the Lord's sight, and so he put them to death. they were to go in and wipe out the Canaanites because of their practices, their idolatry. You can't imagine the evil. I mean, the evil we see today is nothing compared to what the Canaanites were doing. And if you want to see what God said about them, they're in Leviticus 18, you could read. So why did he put him to death? Many of the commentators felt that Judah's line needs to continue on. And these Canaanites were wicked, and God didn't want this line to continue on. So we find God protecting the line of Judah because his family is going to become the royal line. Actually, when you think about the older sons, he's son number four, right? But we have the oldest, Reuben. What did he do? He slept with one of his dad's concubines, so he's out. What about the next two, Simeon and Levi? What did they do? Yeah, they wiped out all the Shechemites. So much for them. So Judah's fourth in line, and we know God is going to choose him to lead his family, but he's not ready in any way, shape, or form. We saw that today for sure. So when died, the next brother in line is Onan, and he's to take the duty of the Levirate. And a Levirate means brother-in-law. The brother-in-law was supposed to raise up an heir that would have the deceased brother's name, so that would continue on. So whatever Tamar and Onan had as a firstborn son would be Ur's son. And Onan didn't like that. What I found interesting is, first off, who's our audience? Israelites coming out of slavery. They don't have the Torah yet, right? Moses is going to give it to it. But this law was already in effect. That was already part of the Hittite laws. So this isn't, again, unique to the Lord. It was what they were doing in the culture at that time anyway. And the purpose was for the brother-in-law to raise up a son that would take care of the widow. He would marry her, but that first son would be responsible for her. So that is why they did that. Verse 11. Judah then said to his daughter-in-law Tamar, "Live as a widow in your father's house until my son Shelah grows up." For he thought, "He may die too, just like his brothers." So Tamar went to live in her father's house. Interesting. The text doesn't often tell us what somebody is thinking, but this time it is. Judah's concerned. Tamar married her, he died. She lay with Onan, he died. If I give her Shelah, he's going to die too, and I only have Shelah left. So go back to your father's house. Wait until Shelah grows up. Interesting, we've talked about the bride price. This is the purpose. When you have the bride price, the groom gives generally animals to the bride's family in the event that something happens to her husband and she returns. The proceeds from those animals would help take care of her. So we're not buying brides, but we're assuring her future. And in this case, it's a perfect example of that. Verse 12. So after a long time, Judah's wife, the daughter of Shua, died. Doesn't give us any time frame. It just says it was a long time. And she dies. So it's only Judah and Shelah left. Verse 12. When Judah had recovered from his grief, he went up to Timnah because the men were shearing his sheep. His friend Hira, the Adullamite, went with him. When Tamar was told, "Your father-in-law is on his way to Timnah to shear his sheep," she took off her widow's clothes, covered herself with a veil to disguise herself, and then sat at the entrance to Enam, which is on the road to Timnah. For she saw that though Shelah had grown up, she had not been given to him as his wife. So once the mourning period is over, Judah goes up and goes back with his friend Hira. He decides to go up to Timnah to check on his sheep. Now, sheep shearing, I guess it would be a little like our Thanksgiving. It's when the sheep are coming in. They're getting the wool. There would be great festivals. There would be drinking. And in the Canaanite culture, this was the time of cult prostitution because it was a time of fertility. So the timing of this was very interesting, but it had been a long time, and Tamar realizes her father-in-law is not going to give her Shelah. So notice, she takes matters into her own hands. We've seen that with the other women, haven't we? She figures out she's going to have to do something to help him out. So she removes her widow's garb and puts on a veil so that she's disguised. There's that word again, deceit. that seems to run in this family. She is going to deceive Jacob. So she sits at the entrance to the village of Enam, the place where you would find a prostitute when you come. And it was interesting to me in my research because the Canaanite culture considered promiscuity a way of life, and prostitution was actually a respectable profession, especially for a woman that didn't have men in her life. So it wasn't viewed as unusual, I guess. Verse 15. When Judah saw her, he thought she was a prostitute, for she had covered her face. Not realizing that she was his daughter-in-law, he went over to her by the roadside and said, "Come now, let me sleep with you." "And what will you give me to sleep with you?" she asked. "I'll send you a young goat from my flock," he said. "Will you give me something as a pledge until you send it?" He said, "What pledge should I give you?" "Your seal, its cord, and the staff in your hand," she answered. So he gave them to her and slept with her, and she became pregnant by him. I wondered if she disguised her voice. He wouldn't recognize her because she had a veil on, so he couldn't see who she was. And that was typical for prostitutes. You didn't know who they were. But the fact that they had a conversation, she must have disguised her voice, either that or he wasn't expecting her.
It had been a while, hadn't it?
It had been a while.
He might not.
Yeah. But he certainly wouldn't expect her to be sitting there at the city gate, that's for sure, even though it was by her home. But she does ask for a security, we might say. But what she asks for is personal ID. The seal is basically a stone that's carved with something unique to him. And it's used to press into wax that would be like your signature or like a notary that would say, "This is Judah and I did this." And notice, he had it with him, right? They always carried it with them. And it was on a cord, which would be some sort of braided thing that would be unique. It would be the right length for Judah, and it would be the right one to hold this stone. And then his staff was hand-carved to his height, his hand measurement. So each one of these would be like his ID. It would be unique from anybody else. So she was very smart to do this. Verse 19. After she left, she took off her veil and put on the widow's clothes again. Meanwhile, Judah set the young goat by his friend, the Adullamite, in order to get his pledge back from the woman, but he did not find her. He asked the men who lived there, "Where is the shrine prostitute who was beside the road at Enam?" "There hasn't been any shrine prostitute here," they said. So he went back to Judah and said, "I didn't find her. Besides, the men who lived there said there hasn't been any shrine prostitute here." Hira's a good friend, isn't he? He's the one that's taking the goat back. He's the one that's trying to find the prostitute. He's the one that talks to the men to try to figure this out. Judah's trying to be honorable to what he said to this prostitute, but he finds out that there is no prostitute there. Verse 23, "Let her keep what she has or we will become a laughingstock. After all, I did send her the young goat, but you didn't find her." We picked up on, he said, "we." Hiram is implicated in this as well, because what? He's bringing the goat. He's asking the question. Everybody knows he was part of this. So they would be humiliated together. And Judah's pointing that out. He said, "Let her keep her. It won't be any benefit to her." Or would it? Look, verse 24. 3 months later, Judah was told, "Your daughter-in-law Tamar is guilty of prostitution, and as a result, she is now pregnant." And Judah said, "Bring her out and have her burned to death." Judah doesn't seem to remember that he had lain with a prostitute near where she lived. But his anger, I bet he thinks it's righteous indignation. After all, she was part of his family. She'd been married to his son. She was pledged to be married to his other son. She had dishonored his family, and he was going to make sure she paid. But he had not fulfilled his part. But he didn't remember that. Now she's pregnant, and she's going to get what's due her. And I think we picked up on the lesson. He probably thought, "Oh, good, now I'll be rid of her for this." He ordered her to be put to death by burning, which is exceptionally cruel. Verse 25, "As she was being brought out, she sent a message to her father-in-law. 'I am pregnant by the man who owns these,' she said. And she added, 'See if you recognize whose seal and cord and staff these are.' Judah recognized them and said, She is more righteous than I, since I wouldn't give her my son Shelah. And he did not sleep with her again. So Tamar is brought out for execution, and she says, the father of this child, these belong to him. Judah immediately recognizes it. Now, Tamar took a lot of risk because she knew if she got pregnant, which is what she was hoping for, she could be put to death. She also knew Judah, and she was anticipating that he would be a man of honor. Even though to us this doesn't seem honorable, he still would honor his word. And that's exactly what she did. But she didn't accuse him. She said, the man who is the father of these children, this belongs to him. And it's Judah's confession. He says, no, she's more righteous than I because I didn't fulfill my end. I did not give her Shelah as her husband. So we're told that Judah took her back into his home and he cared for her, which would be his responsibility now that she's pregnant. But I want us to realize this is the beginning of a turning point in Judah's life. Because God is working on Judah, and he is going to become the leader of these 12 tribes, but he's not there yet. So it's a work in progress, we would say. 27. When the time came for her to give birth, there were twin boys in her womb. As she was giving birth, one of them pulled out his hand. So the midwife took a scarlet thread and tied it on his wrist and said, "This one came out first." But when he drew it back his hand, his brother came out, and she said, "Oh, so this is how you've broken out." So he was named Perez. Then his brother, who had the scarlet thread on his wrist, came out, and he was given the name Zerah. Like Isaac's wife, Rebecca, she also had twins, and they seemed to be jostling in the womb. Who's going to come out first? And we find one sticks out his hand and he gets a cord tied on it, but he brings it back in, and then the other is born first. So the first one born is Perez, which means breaking out. And the second twin that came out with a thread tied on him is Zerah, which may mean scarlet, may mean thread, sunrise, brightness. We're not really sure exactly what this is. So what was interesting to me is, why is this story here? We're talking about Joseph. Well, this story is a little like the old Westerns. You've got the guys riding on the horses going into battle, and meanwhile, back at the ranch. We've got Joseph going into slavery in Egypt, but meanwhile, back into Canaan, this is what is happening with Judah. This actually covers 22 years. It's covering the time from when Joseph is sold until the brothers meet up with him again. So it's giving us the background of what was happening back in Canaan while Joseph is in Egypt. So we'll catch Joseph's story up later. But the Lord is working on Judah to make him a leader. But notice he had to step in once again to preserve his people from themselves, because they seem to be undermining themselves all the time. We find that Tamar does turn to Yahweh. In fact, she becomes a faithful wife to Judah. And the son that is born to Tamar, Perez, you will find in Matthew chapter 1. Perez is the forefather of King David and the forefather of the Messiah. Tamar is listed in the genealogy, but he's also called the son of Judah. So God is working in their lives. He's preserving his people. He's building this nation. And I'm so glad these people weren't perfect, because it gives me hope. God knows that we are all a work in progress, but if he can use people like this, he can use us. So be encouraged. And the other thing I thought, you know, most of us, if not all of us, have family members that are not following the Lord. It would be a good reminder to me and to all of us, keep praying. God is faithful. He can bring them back no matter where they are or what they are. So just keep praying. So let's pray. Father, we just thank you for your faithfulness. Thank you that you use broken people to accomplish your will, but you don't leave us broken, Lord. You continue to work with us. You heal us. You strengthen us. And now you fill us with your very own Spirit. I pray for each one of us here that we would continue to seek you and continue to be your hands and feet in our broken world. We love you, Lord. Amen.